The Tom Woods Show, episode 723.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're like me, you get more email than you can cope with, and you frankly don't know what to do about it. Well, do what I do. Use SaneBox to declutter and get your life back. Check it out at SaneBox, SaneBox.com/Woods. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We are responding to an article today. Those are always fun. Article responses. There's an article that's making its way around the internet. It's called Austrians Are Wrong Again. And it is a response to a piece by Jonathan Newman, who has been on the show before as a panelist on one of the episodes. And it's an article that he wrote on some of the insights that the Austrian school has. And this other person is saying, no, these are not valid insights, or they're not uniquely Austrian, or Jonathan Newman doesn't know what he's talking about, whatever. So this started to spread around, and I had a number of people say, hey, you should answer this. So I thought, what the heck? Now, again, not because it's, you know, let's say it's the best article in the world, but because if people are reading it, I want people to know what the answer to it is. So I'm going to be linking, of course, to the article, to Jonathan Newman's initial piece. All that stuff will be at tomwoods.com/723, of course. And joining me to try and take a crack at this is Professor Jeff Herbener, who is the chairman of the Department of Economics at the outstanding Grove City College. He's also associate editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. And being a cool guy and really smart, naturally he also teaches at libertyclassroom.com, my adult enrichment, learn how to smack down all your friends website. Jeff Herbener, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
So let's go through this. You know, I could have had Jonathan Newman on. It's his article, but I thought, well, I don't know his number, and I know yours. So that's basically how things get done around here. Okay, so obviously we're linking to this at tomwoods.com/723. We're linking to the original article and to this response. And it's, you know, the site that the response is on is by and large a free market site. It looks like a more or less a Chicago school site, if I had to classify it. This person describes himself as a neoclassical economist. So it's not like we're talking to outright leftists who could never be persuaded to listen to reason. But in a way, that annoys me even more. You know, there's no reason for somebody like this to have misconceptions about the Austrian school or to attack us or whatever. So let's go through these 5 points that Jonathan Newman raised and see what the anti-Austrian answer is, and then see what the anti-anti-Austrian answer of Jeff Herbener is, if people are able to follow anything that I'm saying here. All right, here we go. First is the complaint, a common Austrian complaint, that quantitative models miss the nature of human action. Now, that's the way he describes the Austrian criticism. And here's what Jonathan Newman had indeed said. He says, you can't even do basic math with people's preferences for two reasons. Preferences are subjective and preferences are ordinal. You can't measure or compare something you can't observe, and you can't do math with ordinal figures. Adding second place to third place doesn't get you fifth place or first place. It gets you nowhere, which is exactly where mainstream macro is today. So the criticism of that we get from this author is, and again, we don't know the name of this author. It's The Unregulated Economist, whatever that means. And the response to this is that this is a typical Austrian misunderstanding. Quantitative models used by mainstream economists are based on preferences. The preference relationships used by mainstream economists are ordinal. We use utility functions because we have proved theorems about what properties preference relations need in order to be represented by a utility function. If a preference relationship can be represented by a utility function, it means anything that is true for the utility function will be true for preferences. For example, if I prefer oranges to apples, then the utility function gives me higher utility for oranges. The utility function is arbitrary. All that matters is that we are representing the underlying preferences. Another thing we don't do is add the third best and the second best and claim that it is first best. That is a straw man. Well, obviously Jonathan wasn't literally saying they do that. We do, however, take combinations of bundles and can rank them as long as the preferences have certain properties. For example, if I prefer a bundle of oranges to a bundle of apples, then I will most likely prefer a bundle of half oranges and half apples to a bundle of only apples. To argue that mainstream economists are adding ranked bundles the way he represents it shows a complete lack of understanding of mainstream economics. So, Jeff Herbener, does Jonathan Neumann or the Austrian school, do they have a complete lack of understanding of mainstream economics? There's a meatball right over the plate for you.
Yeah, well, by the way, I should say that as a point of context, that Jonathan Neumann's piece is actually a response to another piece by someone in a mainstream publication. And so Jonathan isn't really sort of laying out here a contrast between the Austrian and the neoclassical approaches. He's actually responding to another writer who had criticized the Austrians. but anyway, with that said, what Jonathan, it seems to me that a sort of neutral and unbiased reading of Jonathan's claim is in fact correct. What he says is that we can't do basic math with people's preferences, with the preferences of real human beings. And this I don't think is controversial. I think it's quite accepted on all sides that the bundle ranking and the utility functions and so on are not the preferences of real human beings. They're simply mathematical organizations. They're just mathematical iterations. And of course, if you have a mathematical iteration of bundle assessments, then of course it has certain properties under certain assumptions. But as Jonathan's pointing out, this has nothing whatsoever to do with real people's actual preferences. Real people don't rank all the possible bundles of all the possible goods that could come into their hands of value. They have ends, and they select means that are suitable to the attainment of these particular ends, and they acquire the goods and value them according to the particular ends that particular means achieve. And so really this, I think Jonathan's claim stands just as he stated it. Jonathan, once again, is not trying to make a contrast here or a comparison between the Austrian approach and the neoclassical. He's responding to another author who has written that the Austrians have nothing of use to say. And so he's just pointing out that, well, we do, in fact, have something useful to say. And it's a truth about real people's real actions. By the way, the critic here, he underplays what the conditions are that are necessary for the representation theorems of neoclassical economics to be correct. I mean, he just gives us this example of how there has to be a kind of consistency, transitivity, let's say, in bundle rankings. But actually, in order for the bundle preference rankings to be mapped onto a utility function, the bundle rankings have to be complete, which would mean that for every possible configuration of all the different goods, each taken as a separate set or bundle, a person has to be able to say, I prefer one bundle to another, or I prefer the second bundle to the first, or I'm indifferent between the two. And real people don't do this, and therefore this is just a mathematical, iteration, really.
Let's look at the second one. In the second point is, that Jonathan is making is that the micro-macro separation is baseless, microeconomics and macroeconomics. Now, first of all, not everybody who listens to the show is was an economics major. So just tell people what micro and macro deal with, and then we'll get back to this.
Right. So what Jonathan's referring to, the micro, macro, and mainstream economics, Microeconomics, there is this attempt to ground the analysis in the behavior of economic agents, as we've discussed. So they're trying to value goods and trying to act and achieve ends and so on. In macroeconomics developed, at least under Keynes's tutelage, by looking just at correlations of aggregate data sets. So here we just get something like a like an aggregate demand function or a consumption function at the aggregate level, where total income in the economy is supposed to be correlated with total consumption spending. And so there seems to be this disconnect, and it's always been a tension in mainstream economics, this disconnect between at least the behavior of agents in these models and the result in the aggregate. And so there's been a search, especially since the 1970s, to try to provide micro, what are called microeconomic foundations for macroeconomics. But unlike what the author here claims, this attempt was really just more or less an ad hoc insertion of certain behavioral assumptions that that could be integrated into a more robust modeling procedure. And it didn't really have anything to do with the Lucas critique, but that he mentions.
Well, I know that just from reading one Austrian after another, that the idea that this is an artificial distinction between micro and macro does seem to be fundamental to the way the Austrians look at the world. And he's saying here, well, look, the reason there's a separation is that there's a difference when you're studying one person and when you're aggregating millions of them. So, I mean, is that a legitimate point?
No, I don't think so. I take him to mean that microeconomic models isolate the individual actor, whereas macroeconomic models provide interaction between them. That seems to be what he's saying. But I don't think that's correct at all. I think all economic analysis allows for the interaction between the different agents or persons that they're analyzing. I don't think that's the basic point at all. And so it isn't the problem with aggregating to the macro level is that in mainstream economics is that this aggregation was just taken without any connection to the action of the economic agents at the micro level. There's nothing said about or very little said about how the individuals are acting that bring about the aggregate result. It isn't a question of at the micro level they're not interacting with each other and so they behave in one way, and at the macro level they behave in a different way because they're interacting with each other, which is what I take the author to be saying.
Well, it's interesting that apparently the Grove City College band is walking by while you're trying to make these important points.
Yeah, band camp, you know, the football players are on campus and the band is practicing.
Well, then another point within this point is a point that Rothbard made too, that you in mainstream economics, all of a sudden you get labor economists and economists who focus on these smaller and smaller areas. And if I remember Rothbard's exposition, he said that this is a function of the fact that there is not so much of a sense of economics as being an integrated science with universal principles. Instead, you have to break it down into health economics and labor economics. And this person comes up with responds by saying, "Oh, you're just missing the point. He says we have different fields because we're using different models. You don't model an individual's choice in education the same way you model an aggregation of individuals buying insurance. Nobody can be a master of every model." So is that a good answer?
Right. Again, I don't find that very compelling. I mean, it may be descriptively okay to say it that way, but what Jonathan's point is in bringing this up is to say that, generally speaking, scientific disciplines attempt to find universal principles of cause and effect, And that's what the Austrians do. There's a universal logical structure of action, which has to be the foundation for doing all the analysis in all these different fields. Sure, there are differences that have to be taken into account as well. But what the mainstream seems to lack is a unifying, underlying framework of analysis, that the models are could be, in fact, entirely different and share no sort of basic framework of human action.
Now, this one, number three, economic laws are not just empirical regularities. That's the claim that Jonathan is making. And then the response comes, no economist is claiming this. No one is trying to refute the law of demand with empirical evidence and would not be published if they submitted a paper claiming to do so. Then he says, however, there are ways to logically come to different conclusions. Therefore, we need to look to the real world to find out which is true. Also, logic does not lead to truth. It is a way to understand and analyze arguments. That is a complete intellectual train wreck right there, what I just read.
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing that came to my mind on that, the first point about no one would be published submitting this is Cardin Kruger. You know, minimum wage
of course.
Issue's been in the news lately, and this is exactly what Cardin Kruger did. They said, look, the demand curve for unskilled labor slopes upward to the right. I mean, this is all over the, you know, it's not maybe not the most common sort of claim that's made in the mainstream. But to say that you can't get published doing this is just false on the face.
No, yeah. In fact, that's been one of the most discussed economic papers of, ever since it was published.
And it is true that there's pushback, right? So if somebody does this and gets it published, there's pushback. That is true. But then it begs the question in the neoclassical framework, I mean, on what basis do they claim that demand curves should always slope downward to the right? These are just models that we have to adapt to the conditions of each market. As we're doing this, we have a labor model and we have a health model and so on and so forth. Well, why couldn't it be open to the possibility that demand curves would slope upward? Or don't we have to look out at the real world, as he says, and find out which conforms to what we see in the real world?
Yeah, yeah. Now, of course, the Austrian analysis takes you from examining what is really going on when a human being chooses. And from those implications, you go to the law of diminishing marginal utility and the law of demand. These come right out of that. So that there's no step in that process that's dubious or that is itself open to empirical objection. And so the Austrians are on extremely firm foundations on the law of demand. But as mm-hmm. you say, why would this critic be? How could he be? And then this is just such a horrible paragraph. We have to keep going on it. He says, all right, so no one's trying to refute the law of demand with empirical evidence, even though we just showed there is some. Yeah, these people didn't come out and say we're refuting the law of demand. But what we're talking about obviously involves the law of demand, the
right.
idea of the minimum wage, you know, you don't have to worry about it. But there are ways, let's see if we can even understand what he's saying. There are ways to logically come to different conclusions. What does that sentence mean? What could that sentence mean? Let's try to be as charitable as we can.
Yeah, I'm a little bit mystified by that. If I had to characterize what the neoclassical project is doing, I would say it's not so much the, you know, this like logically I can come to different conclusions. It's that the evidence would be open to the possibility that there are different magnitudes of effects that I can't ascertain by pure logic. That's the way I would think about this. So I'm not sure if that's what he's saying. It doesn't seem to be what he's saying, but,
yeah.
But I think that's a reasonable descriptive statement of how the mainstream economists would view this. Yes, we all agree there's a law of demand. The demand curves always slope downward to the right, but we don't know the elasticity of demand. And that's where we need a model to be able to test the data. And we need a model because the data is complex, many different causal factors that generate the result. And so we have to disentangle them somehow quantitatively or statistically.
But therefore, we need to look to the real world to find out which is true. So again, I just don't. I wish he'd give me an example, because then we could see maybe what he's talking
yeah.
about. We need to. I mean,
I guess he could be saying that if we can invent any sort of model we want, then we can start, you know, one person could propose a model with an upward sloping demand curve, although he denies that they do that, but, and one with a downward sloping demand curve or whatever. Then we could look at the real world. I mean, these models would all be logically, internally consistent. And then we can look at the real world and
okay, you know, that's a good, okay, that's a charitable
certain
way.
Ones and yeah.
Yeah. But I wish we could have David Gordon talk about this. Logic does not lead to truth. I'm pretty sure it does, actually.
Yeah, to put the best reading on this, he might just be referring to the fact that, of course, you need to have, in order to ensure that you reach true conclusions, you have to start with true premises, and then logic would, in fact, lead to truth. So
now there you're being too generous.
Yeah, he may have that in mind when he says that. But this goes right back to what you said before, that this is one of the advantages of the Austrian approach, is that we start with reflective facts about real human action that seem to be acceptable as premises for our arguments.
This is going to be fun because he claims in a minute that everybody knew there was a housing bubble. So we'll get to that after thanking our sponsor. Let's see how much like me you are. Every day, email pours into your inbox, and you get to about 80 to 85% of it. But every day, that 15 to 20% is still there, eating away at you, calling your name at night. And you know you're never, ever going to be able to get back to all of it, and it's frustrating and soul-crushing. Well, I'll tell you something. I emancipated myself from that pit of despair with SaneBox.com. I use SaneBox and I can't live without it. It sorts out my important email from my less important email. It also gives me the option to get certain emails resent to me on days when I'm going to have time to deal with them, so I can clear all my emails out every single day and say, I have reasserted control, baby. Well, check it out at SaneBox.com, that's SaneBox.com/Woods, get a 14-day free trial, and if you decide to stick with it, you get an automatic $25 Tom Woods Show discount. So head over to SaneBox.com/Woods. Okay, before we go on, we've got numbers 4 and 5 to tackle, but you want to go back to something in point number 2.
Yeah, I wanted to mention on this Lucas critique, the author mentions this as an important aspect of introducing micro foundations to macroeconomics.
Yeah, but hold on. Let's make clear. I mean, not everybody knows who Lucas is. We're talking about Robert Lucas.
Mm-hmm. Right, the Chicago economist. By the way, he was also at Carnegie Mellon, so he was a local guy for a while to me.
Okay.
But anyway, so the Lucas critique actually says that if we have an econometric model that we've used past data to estimate the parameters, we shouldn't think that the parameters will be stable in predicting the future effect from a policy change that we implement. It just might be that implementing a policy will change the way people behave and therefore change the parameters. And actually, it seems to me that this is a rather more Austrian-oriented point to make. We could generalize this into the way the Austrians think about this. As Mises liked to point out, one of the problems in doing functional analysis in economics is that there are actually no constants. And so we can't even set up functional equations because we can't divide the phenomena into variables that are changing in constant parameters that don't change. And so he's off the mark a little bit on this Lucas critique, or at least he opens himself up to the other objection that Jonathan Newman doesn't even bring up. Against the use of mathematics in economics.
Nice. Let's hold off on the housing bubble thing, because that is number 5 after all. But you know, Look, it's my show. We're going to go out of order. Let's go to number 5. Austrian economists did predict the housing bubble, and one of his answers is everyone knew there was a housing bubble. Now let's just pause for a minute. James Galbraith said that when it came to the financial crisis, that maybe a dozen or so out of the something like 15,000 professional economists saw that coming. So that's a little different from everyone, right? That's a much smaller percentage. I would say, like, if I wouldn't round that up to 100%, 12 out of 15,000. But then he says, Alan Greenspan and the Fed created a housing bubble on purpose. And so, in other words, everybody knew there was a housing bubble. Now, of course, if everybody knew there was a housing bubble, you know, there would be certain consequences to that. They did this because they handled the bursting of the last bubble so well, they assumed they could handle the housing bubble as well. Therefore, they thought the benefits of the bubble would outweigh the negatives. This wasn't some secret only the Austrians had access to. Moreover, there were many people at the Fed who were predicting it to cause a recession. I think that's an awkward way of saying who were predicting that it would cause a recession. Mm. What's your immediate response to that?
I've actually never heard this claim before, that, you know, there were people in power who understood this, and they assumed that when the bubble did burst, they could handle the fallout. I don't know of any evidence. I've never read anybody making this claim or
What's the citation?
The one that came to mind when I first read this was Tyler Cowen. I think he had said Bob Murphy took him to task for saying right before the bubble burst that some of the Austrians were predicting that it was in fact a housing bubble. He said, well, no, it wouldn't be a housing bubble, because if it were a bubble, then this would happen and that would happen and that would happen. And that's exactly what did happen once it burst, right? These consequences did in fact occur, just as the Austrians had said, just as Tyler Cowen understood would be implications of the Austrians.
Yeah, in fact, yeah, I remember that piece. I'm going to link to that at tomwoods.com/723. That was a beautiful, beautiful thing.
it was a great, great piece. I'm not really sure. I don't know. I wish we had a citation from him so we could read, who it is he's citing that understood this. And, you know, we're saying, hey, let's just let the bubble go ahead and burst. And
and not only that, but I mean, Ben Bernanke said that the fundamentals of the economy are strong and the housing market is perfectly sound. He did not.
Sure.
At no time was there anything in Bernanke's public statements that indicated he believed that there was a bubble.
No.
To the contrary.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
The fundamentals were strong. It was a response to fundamentals. It was not a bubble.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's go back then. Then he says, now, I don't want to make fun of his grammar, but he says, if you want to see how truly poor of thinkers Austrians are, that's just a terrible, you get an F. Just consider this thought experiment. Austrians claim that markets are perfect. Okay. He says in parentheses, not in the sense that you learn in Micro 101, but that markets do not make mistakes.
That's just wrong on the face.
Yeah, we've gotten half a sentence in, and you have to comment. So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the advantages again of the Austrian view is that there's uncertainty of the future, and of course, mistakes are made all the time by entrepreneurs, and it's just that the market it's a self-correcting process. So there's a process where the entrepreneurs who make mistakes are decapitalized, and the entrepreneurs who are superior in their foresight gain capital funding, and then the market muddles through. But I don't know of any Austrian who claims the markets are perfect.
Yeah, but then what he's going to say is Austrian economics has lost in the marketplace of ideas. So either Austrian methodology is a failed experiment because markets do not make mistakes, or the market is imperfect, which means Austrians are wrong. Either way, Austrians need to move on. There have been so many advancements to mainstream economics since Human Action was written that it is embarrassing they are still clinging to it. I don't have the sense that he understands any of the contributions Human Action made, or he understands the Austrians or Mises at all from anything that's written here. But Jeff, what do you think about this claim that since, you know, Austrians aren't the dominant school, that this shows that, you know, either we're stupid heads and obviously wrong, or that our philosophy that markets are always correct. And by the way, as if the academic job market is a free market.
Right.
I mean, hello.
Yeah. No, that's exactly the difficulty, right? I mean, the marketplace of ideas is not a market. And, it's very similar. This kind of argument is very similar to the argument that I hear from my non-economist friends who say, well, capitalism is no good. The free market is no good. Look at the world. It's all messed up. We have all these problems. And, you know, so they can't really disentangle the elements of the real world that are being generated from the market from those that are being generated by the state. So it's a similar kind of problem here, right? There is no marketplace of ideas in the sense of a market.
Incredibly sloppy for an economist to use this figure of speech,
right,
and not realize it's a figure of speech.
Exactly. Right? You know, the good piece on this is Leland Yeager. A few years back, he wrote a nice piece pointing this out, right, making this distinction about marketplace of ideas is really just a metaphor, and it isn't meant to imply anything about the truth value of the ideas that went out in the so-called marketplace of ideas.
All right, let's go back now to number four. And in number four, Jonathan Neumann was saying that Austrian economics is not a collection of vague ideas. So even though empirical testing is out of the question, economics is not reduced to a collection of vague ideas, as Smith put it. Economics, Jonathan goes on, is based on both causal relationships and realistic relationships, which is why some rightfully refer to the Austrian brand as causal realist economics. We do not conjure up some homo economicus who behaves in some predictable way, or consider human behavior as a formula with a stochastic component. We consider real humans as they really act. And now the response from the critic is that the Austrians do not even understand what they are doing. Or I think he means to say what they are doing is a typo there. He says that despite the protestations of Jonathan, he says this is exactly what Austrians do. Why do we get the law of demand? Every single person sees diminishing marginal utility. In other words, every single person acts in a very predictable way. Why did Austrians so-called predict the housing bubble? Because every single person reacts to low interest rates and government policies in a way that would lead to the crisis. In other words, every single person acts in a predictable way. Austrians try to act as if they do not assume humans act in a predictable way, but yet they constantly make predictions about how humans act. Moreover, they constantly brag about being able to predict how humans will act. If humans didn't act in a predictable way, there'd be no reason to do economics. All this fourth point by Neumann has demonstrated is that Austrians do not even understand their own methods, let alone mainstream economists. Well, he means let alone the methods of mainstream economists. So go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, well, this is an illustration of a point you made earlier that he doesn't seem to really have read carefully Human Action or to have comprehended the way in which the Austrians conceive of the difference between economic theory and economic history. But so anyway, I think we said this before, that what the Austrians do with theory, which we do think is exact and gives us the cause and effect structure of action, is isolate or abstract the universal logical structure of action from the particular contingent features of particular actions. We're trying to find what must be logically the case for any and all actions. So that theoretical structure then provides us with a groundwork from which we engage in prediction. And the prediction that we engage in, of course, has to deal with the uncertainty of the future. It has to deal with the quantitative magnitude of the cause and effect relationships, and so on and so forth, that theory does not provide us. So we have to have another augmented way of engaging in that part of economic analysis. And here, The way that Mises suggests we do this is through what he calls specific understanding, through human judgment, so that instead of relying solely on statistical methods, which are, after all, rather weak ways of doing analysis, we can use human judgment, just like the entrepreneurs in the market would use their judgment about the conditions that they anticipate will exist in the future when their profit is either realized or not, and not rely just upon statistical projections. We can do the same kind of thing in economic analysis, in predicting, let's say, the trend of the macro economy, we might just use our judgment of past booms and busts and an assessment of various causal factors that we see put into motion and so on to make our predictions. And part of this we may use statistical analysis to aid us in this, but we don't rely solely upon it.
I remember reading a criticism some years ago of the Austrians on this point that quoted Rothbard as saying that look, a lot of people, you know, some people may want to act in a way that, like, people's value scales are obviously different, and some people may place non-monetary goals very, very high on their value scales, and other people don't. But he at one point said, but since most people do, then we can proceed with the analysis. And the person was saying, well, now, wait, hold on a minute. Where did that come from? Isn't that an illegitimate insertion of a empirical observation into this otherwise logical demonstration?
There are oftentimes, there are a couple of things about that. There are oftentimes empirical generalizations that are helpful in, or maybe even necessary in working out the logic of what's happening in the real world. Another example would be that people have different skills and temperaments and so on to do work. And so, I mean, that we don't logically infer that from some sort of earlier premise, but we just observe this as part of the world. And so I think Jonathan mentions this, that it's from that kind of consideration that we get principles to explain the division of labor. And, so there are reasons to do this. The other thing that might be said in favor of Rothbard's claim is that whatever preference orientations people have toward things, they adjust their actions accordingly. And so they're always acting further. Any additional action they engage in is always in consideration of having fully adjusted, or as far as they are capable, have adjusted to their preferences as they are. And so, people, in other words, when you go to Walmart, let's say, and you buy a toothbrush, when you buy the toothbrush, then you're at, as we like to say, at a point of rest. And the marginal utility of an additional toothbrush is not sufficiently high for you to buy another one. And so we know at that point that only at a lower price would you buy another one. Whereas we wouldn't know that before you bought the first one. And so even people who don't have monetary considerations as a primary end in life have adjusted their actions in such a way that at the margin, when monetary factors change, they too will, it's not unreasonable to think that their behavior would change.
I want to just go back to the housing bubble point for a minute, because I found, it took me 2 seconds to find a list of major experts who resolutely denied the existence of a bubble. Resolutely denied it. And these are top-notch people who are, widely published, or they're commentators who are widely respected. And there's a whole bunch of them. And
right.
I'm sure it's just that's the very beginning. So I'm going to link to that at tomwoods.com/723. Let me jot this down. People who were wrong about housing bubble. And I will not be writing the name Mark Thornton on there, will I?
No.
No, sir. So the idea that everybody saw that, and so that was just easy to see. I mean, come on. criticize the Austrians if you like, but don't say that.
Right. Yeah.
All right. What's your? Let me ask you one unrelated thing before we go. Sort of unrelated. What's your entry point book for Austrian economics for somebody? It's not Economics in One Lesson, but specifically Austrian economics. What's the book that you direct people to?
Well, for someone who actually wants to, master basic economics, I think Bob Murphy's book, Lessons for the Young Economist, is a good introduction.
Okay, I'm writing that down because we're gonna link to that on the show notes page. You can get that book for free, by the way. Although to get a hard copy, it's such a beautiful textbook. Mm-hmm. It's almost a shame to get it for free. You should buy the textbook. But I'll write that down. But also, I know you like his book Choice.
Oh yes, excellent. Choice is excellent, and it gets a little bit more advanced, but it's a wonderful book. It's just a wonderful condensation of Mises' human action. And presentation of it is really great.
All right, good, good, good. So I'm going to link to those at tomwoods.com/723. Now, I realize that I want to acknowledge that some of the material that we covered today is a little on the technical side. It's true. But, you know, we have technical people in the audience, too, and they deserve an episode once in a while. But also, sometimes if that's what it takes to answer somebody whose article is all over the internet, then that's what it's going to take.
Sure.
And so, you know, so we had to do it. So I'm glad we did that. I got to get you on for a Q&A session. You're way overdue for one.
Right.
Over at Liberty Classroom. So we got to get you on there. I'd like to get you on with Bob Murphy.
Oh,
that'd
excellent.
Be fun. All three of us together. So we'll try and do that sometime within the next month.
Great.
All right. Thanks again, Jeff. Great talking to you.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. Before I let you go, a couple interesting items. I mentioned in the discussion just now with Jeff that I found a link where you can read all these experts who were claiming there was no housing bubble. Now, they're not all experts. I mean, some of them are just ordinary commentators. But even so, that's far from saying everybody knew there was a housing bubble. And it's interesting to note that I'm looking, for example, at one person who was obviously just a Republican, the editor of National Review Online, was saying that there is no housing bubble. It's a so-called housing bubble, and argued that really, anybody who talks about there being a housing bubble is just a liberal who doesn't want to admit that George W. Bush has given us a great economy. I mean, that's the level of the analysis. And I'll bet you that back in the early 90s, late 80s, when I was in high school and college, you know, maybe I was still at that level. And I'd be willing to bet some people listening to me speaking right now were at that level at one point. Ah, it must be the liberal media that wants to... You know, and that just poisons everything. You can't think clearly. So she misses a major, major economic event because she's so obsessed with portraying George W. Bush as a conservative. It's just – there's so many things wrong with this. I can't even summarize it all. So I think you'll enjoy looking at this link at tomwoods.com/723. Now, you know, I took some time off from the show. I was doing a couple of episodes a week during the move, and I still don't have a Florida license plate. I mean, it's a horror show. I got so much going on over here. But during that time when I wasn't producing a lot of episodes, I was nevertheless accumulating all these people who started websites. So that's why I've been mentioning a bunch of them lately, because I want to make good on my offer. And then, you know, again, I was releasing two episodes a week, and so now I'm falling behind on that. So I do want to mention to you, I like this site. First of all, it's a beautiful site. It's a site by a guy named Lucas Kagi, and his site, unfortunately, is not easy to convey over the microphone here. LCKEAGY.com. 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 And it is a libertarian blog, but what I like about it is that he is a teacher. And I don't just mean that he's a blogger and so he's teaching us all. He's an actual teacher. And he comes at this project from that point of view. And what I love about his site is this line. He says, "It is my passion to continue learning that I may better teach, and to continue teaching that I may continue to learn." I love that line. And he says, you know, so why on earth do we need another blog? Perhaps we don't, but I do, born out of my own sense of obligation and passion. So there's a lot of good stuff already here on topics that will interest you, about the state and left and right and what's the best way to think about all this stuff. There's a lot of good stuff here. You can check it out at LCKEAGY. That's LCKEAGY.com. Linking to it at tomwoods.com/723, as the listener website mentioned. I give away lots of neat bonuses if you get your hosting through my link, including this little shout-out, plus a nice backlink, some video tutorials, and your own little Facebook group with me where we talk about nothing but blogging, driving traffic, how to solve that tech problem. So lots of great bonuses. Check them out at tomwoods.com/publicity. I don't know what's coming up tomorrow. Absolutely no idea whatsoever. So I guess I will just make an outrageous promise for no good reason and say it is going to be the best episode of the show of all time. I am not going to be able to deliver on that. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.